are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
If you stop to listen, you can hear their hearts beating loud. Keep those California Indians down.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, From Here to There, Past and Present, Settler Colonial Violence and Native American Nations to Palestine. We'll hear an in-depth interview from a leading Palestinian American scholar and activist on the parallels of settler colonialism between what is now the legacy of the United States to that of Palestine. All that and more here on American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone thu'el in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, it's the warriors who are marching down the mountain. Because history ain't no mystery to me.
From Here to There, Past and Present, Settler Colonial Violence and Native American Nations in Palestine, here on American Indian Airwaves. For the hour, I am joined by executive producer and co-host of American Indian Airwaves, Marcus Lopez, as we have the honor and pleasure to interview Dr. Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies in the History Department at Columbia University and is the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. In addition, he was the president of the Middle East Studies Association and an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations from October 1991 until June 1993. He is the author of over 10 publications, including his most recent book titled The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. He joins us for the hour to discuss the Israeli war on Palestine, the recent events in Gaza and the West Bank, the legacy and parallels of settler colonial violence perpetrated against Palestine and its peoples, and draws those parallels to the violent settler colonial legacy here in what is now called the United States and its impacts on Native American nations and how the past connects to the present. We begin today's interview with the question of what is settler colonialism?
I mean, settler colonialism is pretty easy to discern. It's essentially overseas European export of populations to take the place of indigenous populations. You know, there's regular colonialism where Europeans would go overseas and rule over other countries, but not export their populations to that countries and try and replace the existing indigenous populations. So, you know, India was ruled as a colony. It wasn't a settler colony. The English didn't send English people to settle in India, which they did in, obviously, Turtle Island, North America, which they did in Australasia, what is now Australia and New Zealand, which they did actually earlier on in Ireland. In all of those cases, what you're talking about is overseas European expansion, but also the settling of populations in an attempt to replace as much as possible the indigenous population. That's settler colonialism. It's a post-1492 European colonial phenomenon. And it's part of this wave of colonial expansion of these European countries.
Thank you very much. Now the other one is, how do you define Zionism?
Mm-hmm. Well, Zionism has multiple aspects to it. On the one hand, it is an Eastern European, let me put it this way, it's a nationalist movement among Jews, mainly in Eastern Europe, in response to persecution and anti-Semitism. It's an ideology which says that Jews cannot live among non-Jews, and that they should reconstitute, in their view, a national existence in some other part of the world. Eventually, it was decided that that part of the world should be Palestine, and so that's one aspect of it, or one of those are two aspects of it. One is this the development of national ideas in the late 19th century among some Jews, a tiny minority of Jews originally. And the other is that this is, in part at least, a reaction to European persecution and anti-Semitism of Jews, which is historic. It goes back millennia. I mean, it goes back, you know, all of the Jewish population of England is kicked out in the 12th century. All the Jewish population of France is kicked out in the 13th century. All of the Jewish population of Spain and Portugal are kicked out at the end of the 15th century. So this is historic persecution, and this is, in part, a response to that. The third aspect of it is a collaboration with European imperial powers and adoption of settler colonial methods. In other words, Zionism is not just an attempt to see the Jews as a modern national entity, and it's not just a response to persecution and anti-Semitism in Europe. It's also an attempt to take over a land that was already inhabited by a native indigenous population, the Palestinian Arab population, by European settlers with the backing of an imperial power. It's there, in that sense, it's a settler colonial project, like many others, and in some ways different from the others.
Thank you very much. I want to get that people can have an understanding of that, and I want to turn now quickly to your book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. When you said on the book, and you started, fascinating reading because it's a declaration of maneuverability of imperialists, particularly the British. But I think most of all, especially the importance, is the most important of them were the Palestine integral part of the Ottoman Empire, mm-hmm. and most gravely in its inhabitants by others. And then later on, you say in the name of God, let Palestine be left alone. This notion of 1898 letter to the Jewish head of the new Zionist movement about their going into that area by Yusuf Deya. And
right.
Talk about, number one, this phenomenal aspect of, like you said, the book started in 1917 or even before that, but yet what started that Yusuf and your relatives talked about that notion of a declaration by Europeans, especially the British. Give us a notion of a little bit of overview of the book.
What I was trying to do with this book is to dispute and to basically refute a notion, or many notions, about what has been going on in Palestine ever since the late 19th century. And there are all kinds of images that this has been going on since time immemorial, that Arabs and Jews have always been fighting, that this is simply a desire to, on the part of Arabs, for reasons of anti-Semitism or some other reason, to thwart the inalienable rights of the Jewish people to self-determination and so on and so forth. What I try and show in this book is that, in fact, this all of this suffering has essentially been framed by the intervention of European imperialism, the British in particular, in 1917 when they occupied Palestine and issue the Balfour Declaration. It's been framed by the rise of nationalism among Arabs and among Jews. And it's been framed by the settler colonial methodology that the Zionist project adopted in order to attempt to turn Palestine from an Arab country into a majority Jewish country. And this entailed what I describe as a war on the Palestinians, sometimes waged by the British, often waged by the State of Israel, sometimes waged by other powers against the Palestinian people in order to force them to relinquish their rights in their ancestral homeland. So I see this as a multi-phase war. Going back to 1917, obviously Zionism goes back earlier, Arab nationalism, Palestinian nationalism goes back a bit earlier, but it becomes a war the moment that Britain intervenes, the moment that Britain occupies Palestine, the moment that the British issue the Balfour Declaration, which says that there's essentially only one people in Palestine with national rights, which is the Jewish people, and which completely ignores the overwhelming Palestinian indigenous majority, 95% of the population at the time. They're never mentioned by name in the Balfour Declaration or in the mandate for Palestine that the British get from the League of Nations, on the basis of which they rule Palestine up until 1948. So the book starts, as you mentioned, with a letter that was sent by a relative of mine, a great-great-great uncle, to the leader of the Zionist movement at that time, Theodor Herzl, in which he tells him that Palestinians, Muslims and Jews, he says, are of course cousins. You know, we're all children of Abraham, he says. And we recognize the suffering of the Jewish people. We recognize your connection to this land. But, he says, you're attempting to settle here and to take this country over is going to cause problems, because there's a population here that will refuse to be supplanted, the Palestinian Arab population, the overwhelming majority of the population at the time. And he says, he ends that part of the letter by saying, for the sake of God, leave Palestine alone. And so that's what you were referring to there.
Thank you very much. And the book goes on to the declarations, the first declaration of war, third, fourth, fifth declaration, sixth declaration, in the sense of this notion of a continual effort, like war, you said, first the European powers and secondly by the State of Israel. If you were trying to explain the book and its particular declarations, what do you see as the main point you want to get across to the reader?
Well, one of the points to get across to the reader is that, contrary to the image of Israel as a tiny little isolated, beleaguered, you know, outpost in a sea of hostile Arabs, these are images that we get out of, you know, that parallel the images that you have in American film westerns of isolated settlers surrounded by hostile natives. There's a playing on that imagery on the part of Zionists, especially in their propaganda directed at the United States. Instead of that, which is a false image, of course, what you have, in fact, is resistance to an attempt to take over the country by these intruders, by these settlers, by these Europeans, on the part of a native population. And obviously this should be familiar to any indigenous person in the United States or in Canada or in Australia or in New Zealand. The same kind of processes were taking place here and in Australia and New Zealand as were taking place in Palestine. The fact that Jews had a claim or felt they had a claim, the fact that Jews were being persecuted in Europe is obviously relevant. It's germane. But that has been centered. That has been described as the only thing that's important. The fact that Palestinians were simply saying, you can't take over our country and we will resist that, has always been elided. So I'm trying to frame this as a war against the Palestinians by overwhelmingly superior forces. It's not tiny, beleaguered little Israel. It's powerful Israel, supported by the greatest world powers of the age. The British Empire controlled a quarter of the globe at the time that they occupied Palestine in 1917. And they were, in fact, expanding their empire at that time. They were the victor of World War I. They had armies that were fighting all over the world at the time. And getting the support of Great Britain was an enormous victory for the Zionists. And they were the ones who, in fact, ensured the establishment of what later on became the State of Israel through helping to build up the institutions, the military forces, the structures, the diplomatic capacities of what was later on to become the State of Israel. So having the British on your side means you have the big battalions on your side. It means you're not a tiny isolate. Obviously, you're a small group. You're a minority at the time in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. But you have enormous support. Later on, they come to have the support of the two great superpowers after World War II. The United States and the Soviet Union are supportive of the State of Israel. They force a resolution that gives most of Palestine to a Jewish state in the United Nations in 1947. They arm the State of Israel. They recognize the State of Israel, and they back it against the Palestinians and later on against the Arab state. So I'm trying to shatter this entirely false image that, in fact, it is the Palestinians and the Arabs who are the overwhelmingly powerful party, and that Israel is a tiny little beleaguered state. In fact, Israel is a superpower, which has never lost a war, a regional superpower. Israel is a nuclear power. Israel has the United States at its back. I mean, we can see this in the Gaza War, the 120-millimeter tank shells, artillery shells, the 155-millimeter artillery shells are being shipped by the United States to enable Israel to fight this war. They can't fight without that stuff. They can't fight without replacements for their Apache helicopters. The name is interesting, by the way. Yes. They can't fight without their F-15s, their F-16s, their F-35s. All of this is American-supplied equipment and ammunition. Israel is fighting a war, but America is in that trench alongside Israel fighting the Palestinians. And that's always been the case. There's always been an external patron, an imperial power, a great power, that meant that the balance was always tipped in favor of the Zionist project early on and later on the State of Israel.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Palestinian scholar and activist Dr. Rashid Khalidi on From Here to There, Past and Present, the legacy of settler colonial violence perpetrated against Native American nations to Israelis' occupation and war on Palestine. And now back to the interview.
Thank you for that. It, within the book, it goes intertwined within many aspects of it. I don't want to cover that in particular. There's so much to cover in this book. But you said in particular that Gaza was the only rarely permitted Gaza was in effect turned into an open air prison.
Right.
Where in 2018, at least 53% of some 2 million Palestinians lived in the street of poverty.
Right.
And you go on. And the litany of oppression, of the degradation of a peoples, within that, that set up the conditions for a continual resistance of the people. And what about today? Your particular projections of the end of the book, what about today? What is going on from your vantage point?
I mean, we barely have an hour for this, and we're not talking about an easily explained situation. Just very briefly, first of all, most of the people in the Gaza Strip are descendants of refugees driven from their homes by Israel in 1948 from the parts the areas that now form southern Israel, cities like Ashkelon, which becomes Ashkelon, Be'er Seba, which becomes Be'er Sheva. Ashdod, which becomes Ashdod, are Palestinian cities, and there are Palestinian towns and villages, all of which are emptied of their populations by the Israeli army in the war of 1948. And those people are driven into what becomes the Gaza Strip. They are governed by Israel, by Egypt for a while under military government, and then later on in 67, Israel occupies the Gaza Strip as part of its occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights. And from that moment until today, the lives of the Gazans are completely controlled by Israel. Israel controls the population registry. Israel controls entry and exit into Gaza. Israel basically enters Gaza whenever it chooses, even after Israel withdrew its settlers that it had planted in Gaza after 1967, when it did that in 2005 and withdrew its military forces from Gaza. It continued to enter into Gaza and continued to control Gaza from without. The airspace is controlled by Israel. The sea is controlled by Israel. Fishermen can only go out a couple of kilometers, after which the Israelis will sink their fishing boats. Entry and exit is controlled by Israel. Import and export is controlled by Israel. What communications they can have with the outside world. So it's an occupation at a distance, has been the situation since 2005. And that occupation has turned into a siege over the past 19 years, fences, walls, and so on and so forth, such that most of the population of Gaza, which is under 20 years old, under 18 years old, actually, have never been allowed to leave the Gaza Strip. So this area of 20 miles by 5 miles has become, in effect, an open-air prison in some respects. And that's the background to what happens on the 7th of October. And from an Israeli perspective, everybody, they want to start, everything is on the 7th of October. There's this horrific attack by Hamas, which leads to an enormous number of casualties among Israeli civilians, probably the largest Israeli civilian casualty toll since the 1948 war. In fact, undoubtedly the highest Israeli civilian casualty toll. There are also hundreds of soldiers and security personnel who are killed, in addition to the about 800 Israeli civilians. So this is a huge shock to Israel, and Israelis want to focus only on that and say, this is an atrocity, this is a massacre, this is... In addition to that, of course, a couple of hundred, over 200 Israelis are taken hostage or captured and taken into the Gaza Strip, and about half of them are still being held there as hostages after about half of them were released back in November in an exchange of hostages for Palestinian prisoners. So the situation that Israel would like us to focus on is the horrors of what happened on the 7th of October, the attacks on the Israeli military, but more importantly, the attacks on Israeli civilian settlements. And that is undoubtedly an important part of the picture, and the traumatic impact of it is undeniable, and the horrors are, we know about some of them now, and there are perhaps others we'll learn about. What nobody wants to talk about is what Israel has done since then, which is to kill about almost 30,000 Palestinians, the overwhelming majority of whom are civilians. Over 11,000 of them are children. So 800 Israeli civilians were killed, which is horrific. 28,000 Palestinians have been killed. Again, the overwhelming majority of them civilians, probably 80% of them civilians. There are 8,000 people, 7,000 people missing. Undoubtedly, almost all of them are buried under the rubble of their homes. The Israeli bombardment of Gaza and the nature of the war that it's waged in Gaza has destroyed maybe 30% of the structures in Gaza, including almost all of the infrastructure, the water purification plants, the sewage plants, the hospitals, the universities, the libraries. All of these things have been systematically destroyed, not by accident and not in combat. Some of them were, the demolition charges were placed under them and they were just destroyed. So there's been what South Africa, in its submission to the International Court of Justice, has described as a potential case of genocide. Certainly what you've had is a systematic attack, not just on the population, but on the infrastructure. Not only have maybe 68 or 70,000 people been wounded and over 30,000 people been killed, which is 4.5% of the population of the Gaza Strip. Most of the population have been driven from their homes again and again and again, driven from the north to the center, driven from the center to the south, driven from one part of the southern part of the Gaza Strip to another. There's an attempt now to empty the area they were forced into by Israel, the Rafah area. So you have had multiple repeated dislocations. We're not talking about anything as long as the Trail of Tears. We're not talking about anything as long as the forced expulsion of populations across the North American continent, but we're talking about within this small space people being forced to move again and again and again at gunpoint and as a result of bombardments. So that's the situation today. There is an enormous humanitarian catastrophe underway, supported by this country, it should be said, supported systematically by the United States, which refuses to insist that Israel accept a binding and lasting ceasefire, which refuses to stop shipping the weapons with which Israel is doing this and the ammunition with which Israel is doing this.
Rashid, I have a question for you. In listening to you and what's been happening since October 7th, and I was wondering if we could make the connections back to, you know, I'm thinking of the 30s and obviously up into the 1940s. And, you know, I just think about Palestinian resistance to British occupation and, you know, the collusion with France and the Sykes-Picot Treaty of 1916.
Right.
But the labor resistance to British occupation in 1936. But also the establishment of kibbutz, these military outposts, into Palestine and how that, you know, structures settler colonialism, if you will. And I'm thinking of, you know, historically here, colonists, you know, creating or establishing forts in indigenous people's lands. And some of these forts today went on to become cities like Detroit. But some of these forts are war camps or prisoner of war camps like Pine Ridge, which is known as War Camp, I think, 334. And take us back to that time period, because these military outposts, right, really structure settler colonialism in violent ways that dispossess indigenous Palestinians of their traditional homelands, but it also contributes to the conditions that Palestinians live under in Gaza and the West Bank before, you know, October 7th of 2023.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the resonances and the echoes are really very striking. Mm-hmm. A lot of these outposts are established in the 20s and the 30s. Mm-hmm. Tower and stockade. I mean, if you look at, again, I go back to these horrific Westerns. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way in which the expansion of settler colonialism into the American West is portrayed, you will see towers and stockades. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you look at pictures of the early Zionist settlements in the 20s and the 30s, and they're exactly the same structures, towers and stockades. In the 20th century variant, there's also barbed wire, but you are talking about very similar processes in some ways. Mm. You're talking about a militarized expansion westward in the case of this country, and a militarized expansion into lands in Palestine by groups of what they call pioneers. Again, the resonances are, and that's a term that's still in use in Israel. People are described as pioneers. They're pioneering their way into a hostile territory. So the resonances are enormous, and you don't have the cavalry. You don't have the cavalry as you have in the American case. You have the British Army in the 20s and the 30s doing the dirty work for the settlers, who also are armed. They have their own the settlers themselves are armed, but it's the might of the British Army that ultimately prevails in the 1930s when the Palestinians realize what's happening and finally stop trying to negotiate with the British and first of all launch a great general strike in 1936 and then launch an armed uprising against the British, which lasts for 3 years. About 14, 15, 16, we don't know the exact point, maybe 15 to 17% of the adult male Palestinian population are killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled by the British in crushing this revolt. Mm. 15 to 17% of adult males are killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled by the British as they crush this enormous revolt, one of the greatest interwar anti-colonial revolts internationally in that period. And again, the similarities are chilling. To you know, the great campaigns carried out by the U.S. military in support of settler colonialism all over this continent.
I think of not only in the militarization of Palestine in the 30s, but even leading up to the 40s. But I also think of how colonists treat the land in terms of when it comes to surveying, if you will, and I'm being sanitized in the terminology here, surveying the lands and determining whether or not Palestinians can prove title to the land. And that reminds me of the colonial legacy here with the doctrine of discovery and doctrine of dominion, you know, and colonists treating the lands here or the Western Hemisphere, you know, as terra nullius and this, you know, giant tableau Rousseau, this empty slate to colonize. But that becomes a colonial tool to dispossess indigenous peoples of the land. But it structures an apartheid system that Israel has already been found or recognized as being guilty of the crime of apartheid, in part due to this kind of militarized allotment system that leads up to the conditions of Palestinians that have lived under for decades now. Your thoughts?
Well, in the case of Palestine, one of the most important tools that was used to implant the Zionist project in Palestine was an alliance with the British, which enabled them to construct the legal means whereby land could, legal quote-unquote means, whereby land could be alienated. Yeah. One of the terms of the mandate that the British are given by the League of Nations is that they're supposed to encourage land purchase. And one of the things that that involves is overriding traditional collective control of land with notions, Western notions of private property, which then enable the, quote, purchase of land and the dispossession of the people who actually worked it. So it went through very different means, but the end was the same. The project always involved land and demography, taking control of the land and changing the demography. And it's done in different ways by each settler colonial project. In the case of Ireland, it was done in one way. In the case of Algeria, it was done in another way. In the case of this continent, it was done in several different ways. In the case of Palestine, it was done through quote-unquote legal means, which the British administration, up until 1948, facilitated. And then you had all kinds of expropriations. After 1949, Zionist quote-unquote land purchase in these unequal, unfair conditions, only enabled them to control 5 or 6% of the land at the time of the 1948 war. The rest of the land was owned by Palestinians, or was commonly owned. And in the subsequent decades, all kinds of legal subterfuges have been used to take over land that was owned by Palestinians before 1948.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Palestinian scholar and activist Dr. Rashid Khalidi on From Here to There, Past and Present, the Legacy of Settler Colonial Violence Perpetrated Against Native American Nations to Israelis' Occupation and War on Palestine. And now back to the interview.
I could go into the details. I don't think your listeners would really be interested. But most of the land in what is today Israel is, in fact, or was, in fact, Arab-owned. Mm. You know, on the cover of my book, there's a picture of my grandfather's house. Mm. We don't have control of that property. It's a ruin today. Yeah. On the outskirts of Jaffa, near Tel Aviv. We don't have control of that property. It went into the hands of something called the custodian of absentee property, and then into the hands of the Israeli state through all kinds of quote-unquote legal expropriations of the property of Palestinians who were either driven out or forced to leave or had to flee, or even of Palestinians who stayed in Israel and became Israeli citizens, but who were dispossessed of their land in a variety of quote-unquote legal means. So land is, as in any settler colonial case, in this country and elsewhere, land is key to that process.
And that concludes part one of our two-part interview with Dr. Rashid Khalidi. We're speaking on From Here to There, Past and Present, Settler Colonial Violence in Native American Nations to Palestine. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. ياما قلنا بكرة أحلى بس لا ما شفنا إلا قهر طلبنا بس حرية نعيش شفنا بس قتل وتهجير حتى نحكي لا ممنوع سجن حدود وسجن بتعبي وزنبو يا طفل الشهيد كان حلمه مستقبل زهيد واللي عايش طفل تاني بس أهله ميتين صاير فينا على ترابك ما تخلينا ودم الشهيد فداك يا وطني تبلينا وراح اللي بوزينا وش كل بينا والله ما توحش ناس اللي جوتني كل يوم بحكوا لي صبر سلاحي واخر صبر الموت والكل شايف بس لا مش فارق صوتي حال وانا واقف وحدي العالم ضدي وانا مخشى سلموني روحي حتى الارض تعيش مفتاح البيت بقلبي وانا راجع وبايدي ولدي ولو كل العالم كان ضدي
وين الحكام العرب وين القادة واتي في غزة اليوم تتعرض للإبادة وما كلمتينا من نصر ما شهادة فلسطيني شهيد منذ تاريخ الولادة وصبرا جميلا العدو سيزول وين الأمة العربية حان الوقت لننثر في بال وعد الحق يوفى وعد الفور وانا قلبي فلسطيني على في العمور
كل الدنيا بلادي وأرضي في كل مكان كل الدنيا بلادي من قديم الزمان الفروق بينها حدود كلام على الورق مكتوب والمكتوب أصبح قيود تمنعنا نشوف
قتلونا وهجروني وصار الحجر بيدي سلاحي مثل الدم ابيض واسود جوفيتي هزر نجاحي وبكفي كفاني شايل وبكفي كر اللي جاي مفتاح البيت على الرقب بسداد ما بتمايل
مفتاح البيت قلبي وانا راجع وبايدي ولدي ولو كل العالم كان ضدي انا راجع يا بلادي راجع البيت قلبي وانا راجع وبايدي ولدي ولو كل العالم كان ضدي انا راجع يا بلادي راجع
الهي رفعت يدي اليك بان تفك كربي وهمي وانت المستجيب
بلاد العرب وطاني من الشام بغداني ارضي هي وبلادي وكل العرب بتنادي احتلالي عدواني موت طفلي واجدادي اسألني مين ارهابي وجاي اقول لك مين بادي
سوري اني مش من اوكرانيا سوري انه بشرتي مش بيضة سوري لأولادي سوري اني جبتكم على دنيا منفقة ومش عدلة سوري الحلم طويل يابا سوري الحمل ثقيل يابا لا سوري على اي سوري ملناش غير انه نشيل يابا
هنا الموت حياة سهلة بس صعب الحياة حرية كذابة عالم استبدادي
نستقبل ضيوف نستقبل شهداء
منسينا الدرة وقصف المعمداني
عبادة جماعية اطفال ونساء
يموت عزيز من يبكي دا شهيد
نصرة نصرة تبقى العزة لله
راجعين يا اقصى وعد الله اكيد
ماكو تهجير جبل ثابت بناها بالتفجير
يا خزعت انتصار انا قادم اكيد
بصمودي قاهر ضعك الخبيث
بالمشاعر بليد
ما شاف احد من عياله شهيد
ارواح امانه برقاب الجميع
امانه شريف
بنوصل ندافع نموت بقى فلسطين
اطاري بشعبشع منه تخون خليك يقول صراحه يقطعوا الصوت بدمو اللي خايف الدوي اللي حبسوا له كونت اخي الدم فار القلب مشوله ما قدراش يشوف داك الشيء اللي مصور شطن غاز في العرش واللي معكسور صار بين خف سرطان 75 محط الرصاص مشي شي
فاضل ما يشفى حتى ناخذ دار المستشفى ظلموا صاروا بالكشفة وين رجال قلوب نشفة صعبي ماما الدنيا تقسى زادت النكسة ظلموا فايت حدو لقسى سلامي لغزة مش نقسى شالا نتقبلوا في اللقسة
والأرض هيلينا لو فوق الأرض وتحتيها سوقها وجمع تلاقينا بتفان يزولوا وحمية
The song Rajaheen are in English We Will Return. The song is a single by 25 different artists from 11 Middle Eastern and North African countries. The song was released on October 31st of 2023 to raise awareness of the suffering of the Palestinian population amongst Israel's war and occupation of Palestine. In the second half of our program today here on American Indian Airwaves, we continue with our interview with Dr. Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies in the History Department at Columbia University and is the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. He is the author of over 10 publications, including his most recent book, The Hundred Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. He joins us for the entire hour to discuss Israel's war on Palestine, the recent events in Gaza and the West Bank, the legacy of settler colonialism perpetrated against Palestine and its peoples, and he draws the parallels to the violent settler colonial legacy here in what is now called the United States and its impacts on Native American nations and how the past connects to the present. And now part two of our interview, From Here to There, Past and Present, Settler Colonial Violence in Native American Nations to Palestine.
You stated within the book, especially what Baal Ahmad summed it up in 47, and then finally you said it moved from a colonial menace to exclusivist settler colonialism. What do you mean by that?
Well, when you take over a country that has an Arab majority, which is what was the case in which is the situation in 1948, and you drive the larger part of that population out, and then you set up a state on most of what was, you know, the Palestine Mandate, the State of Israel, after the 1948 war, in which the dispossessed and expelled populations are not allowed to return, and their property is expropriated, and Jewish citizens of that new state get some rights that the Arabs who remain behind and become citizens do not have, you're talking about an exclusionary and discriminatory system where anyone who is Jewish has certain rights that anyone who is not does not have. And that's what I mean by exclusionary. And that's the case with Israel to this day. It's the propagandists for Israel will say it's a Jewish and democratic state. Well, you can't be in a state which overtly proclaims the supremacy and exclusive rights of its Jewish population at the expense of what is now a 20% Arab majority, a minority inside Israel, and at the same time say that it's fully democratic. It can't be. And it's certainly not democratic because it rules over millions of other Palestinians in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip who don't have citizenship and, in fact, don't have any rights at all. What kind of democratic state has ruled for 56 years over a population in the occupied territories that has literally no rights, no control over the decisions that are made by an Israeli government, which decides what it does with them through a military rule that has lasted for, as I've said, for 56 years.
So another example of that would be this idea of juridical and imperialism, if you will. And I think there's something like over 65 Israeli laws, including many land laws that you referred to, that actually do not apply to Palestinians today inside the 1948 territories. And with other examples, such as the Israeli settlers living in the 67 territories, are tried under Israeli civilian courts, while Palestinians are tried under military courts. And it, again, thinking of colonial times here in the States and even up into, you know, the 20th century here in the States, when indigenous peoples, encounter settler colonial law, it is the colonial law that takes precedent and still does in many ways today. Marcus?
Mr. Khalidi, in your book, you ended up in a very firm particular position, and you talked about the ethnic cleansing. You talked about the law, like Larry suggested. You talked about inequality and injustice within the areas. You talked about the ending of the book and about any negotiations the United States needs to be step aside because of the fact that they go, and the history shows, the side of Israel's state in any negotiations, but about how two-party, the inside as well as the Israelis, as well as the Palestinians, the challenge for them is to talk and is to go from a situation of not armed struggle to the situation of negotiations. Please talk about that for the end of the book. And then I want to get to the issue of this New York editorial that Brett Steppens about this settler colonialism, but please talk about the end of the book, some of the, so quote unquote, I know it's difficult, but your summation of where we need to go at this point.
Right. Well, that's a hard question, where we need to go at this point. A couple things. First of all, as I argue in the book, no solution that does not give absolutely equal rights and that recognizes and that doesn't recognize historical injustice is gonna fly. It won't be sustainable. It won't last. It won't work. And it's unjust and it's immoral. You have to accept that a historical injustice has been done to the Palestinian people. You have to accept the settler colonial origins of Israel. You have to accept that you have to also accept that there are two peoples there. Palestinians have to accept that there's now an Israeli people, and Israelis have to accept that there's a Palestinian people. And that has to go with absolutely equal rights. Any solution which says we'll have an Israeli state that has this, this, and this, and we'll have a Palestinian state that has less than this, this, and this, that's not just, and it's not going to work. It's not going to last. It's not sustainable. There have to be absolute equal rights, whether we're talking about a two-state solution, a one-state solution, a binational state, a cantonal solution. There's all kinds of possibilities, a regional confederation. But whatever solution ends up being adopted has to involve absolutely equal rights, national rights, political rights, civil rights, human rights, property rights, religious rights, all of those have to be absolutely equal. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you cannot have a negotiation between two parties where one party chooses the other side's negotiators. That has been the case up till now. I was involved in negotiations in Madrid after the Madrid Peace Conference, where the Israelis decided who could and couldn't be on the Palestinian delegation. Well, if it were up to me, and there were a lot of war criminals, I wouldn't allow to be on the Israeli delegation. But it's not up to me to choose who negotiates for Israel. But it is an American and Israeli prerogative to say, this group is excluded, this person is excluded, we will speak to this person and only this person. So you can't have that kind of negotiation. You have to have a selection by each side of its own representatives, whether you like them or not, whether you consider they have blood on their hands or not.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Palestinian scholar and activist Dr. Rashid Khalidi on From Here to There, Past and Present, the Legacy of Settler Colonial Violence Perpetrated Against Native American Nations to Israelis' Occupation and War on Palestine. And now back to the interview.
Most of the people that we negotiated with, many of the people, I should say, that we negotiated with and the Palestinians have negotiated with are former generals. And they have blood on their hands. The Palestinians sit down with them. That's the only way you can get anywhere, if you deal with the people who have power and who have been involved militarily or politically or whatever it may be. That's the way in which ultimately a resolution was arrived at in Ireland. That's the way a resolution was ultimately arrived at in South Africa. They didn't just sit down with the people whom the South Africans considered, you know, their favorite South African native and indigenous peoples. They sat down with the representatives chosen by the South Africans, the ANC, who were, among other things, a military group that carried out all kinds of violent resistance to apartheid. Similarly in Ireland, the Irish won their independence in 1921 of the Irish Free State through a negotiation that involved the Irish Republican Army, the people who had fought the British. And that's the same thing that happened in the 1998 Good Friday agreements. The British didn't pick the representatives of the Irish. The IRA sent the people it chose to negotiate. And that's how it's going to have to be. The last thing is, you cannot have as the mediator, the enabler, the ally, the strongest supporter of one of the parties as supposedly the honest broker or the mediator. The United States cannot play that role. Is the United States going to have to be involved in a negotiation? Yes. But I've always argued it should be sitting on the other side of the table with the Israelis, which is where they belong. Because they, without the United States' support, Israel would not be able to do what it does. This is a central to my way of thinking. Anybody but the United States would be a better third party, a better mediator, a better honest broker. So I think all of those are essential. How we get to that wonderful situation where we could have a negotiation, I really don't know. We're not there right now, unfortunately.
Thank you very much. Larry and I commented, some editorials came out in New York Times about settler colonialism needs to be, why not get rid of settler colonialism? And then the author, an op-ed in New York Times, went in all different directions about atonement and about, well, let's American citizens of non-native descent leave. Well, this article goes in this nonsensical argument, but yet the same parallels with settler colonialism and the subject matter of the Palestinians as a people never got addressed as a people within negotiations. Right. The primary point that you point out in the book, but yet right. Also with colonialism within North America, many of the indigenous nations, and Larry and I constantly bring this up, no treaty rights have been implemented.
Exactly.
Whether it be the Lakotas, whether it be the Chumash, where there would be different, I don't know how many hundreds of treaties that never been implemented within the United States alone. And then this, the parallels are extraordinary. We wanted to bring them up. The fact that I know Larry has a question or some comments. The Eastern United States, especially the Western United States, about the rebellion, the Chumash here, the Modoc Wars, the Kauaias and different, the Hashimam, the people who resisted, the mission system, all that stuff. And even back east, Larry, I know some has some comments on. But the parallels are so alarming, you know, that I think we want to bring it up in the sense of educating people, in the sense of they have to really understand the history of this land, the history of that land over there, and the realizing the atrocities, and realizing what the Pope even mentioned as not only ethnic cleansing, but the genocide of both areas. And that needs to be addressed.
Well, I think you're right. The parallels are absolutely striking. I mean, the number of agreements that were negotiated between the time that we went to Madrid in 1991 into the 2000s and that have never been implemented by Israel is just striking. I mean, obviously, the history here goes back hundreds of years. We're talking, you know, from the 17th century right up until the 20th century. In the case of Palestine, it's only a couple of decades, but the parallels are absolutely striking. Agreements are made that are never implemented. There's supposed to be a corridor between the West Bank and Gaza Strip, never implemented. There were supposed to be Israeli withdrawals, never implemented. I mean, I could go on and on and on about the terms of what I consider to have been very bad agreements. I would never have accepted those agreements if it were up to me, but the PLO did accept them. In the 1990s and into the early 2000s, never implemented on the Israeli side. And so I think that you're absolutely right. The parallels are completely striking. And this article that you're talking about by Brett Stevens in the New York Times, it's a really quite shameful piece because, I mean, how can you deny the settler colonial origins of this American project? It's impossible to deny it. And I would argue you can't deny the settler colonial origins of the Zionist project. They called it colonial. I mean, one of the big land purchase agencies, one of the agencies that was charged with acquiring lands for the Zionist project, called itself the Jewish Colonization Agency. Okay? That's not some anti-Semitic slur by some fanatical Arab professor sitting in an Ivy League university. That's what they called themselves. And it existed up until 1958, this institution. Later on, it called itself the Palestine Jewish Colonization Agency. Okay? So the colonial nature of this process and the parallels with settler colonialism in Algeria or Ireland or North America or Australasia are undeniable. And, you know, it's a fundamentally dishonest piece by Brett Stevens in the New York Times in which he elides all kinds of important things. You have to accept that this is the truth of history. It doesn't necessarily tell you what you do with that truth, but you have to start from there if you want to get somewhere honest, you want to get somewhere just, and you want to get somewhere moral. What it means in terms of the relationship between the settler population and between the indigenous population is a matter to be decided over time and in different ways in different places. In Ireland, it's hopefully going to be decided in one way. In South Africa, it's been decided in another way. In Palestine, God knows how it will be decided. But in this country, God knows how it will be decided. It's not a closed book, is the point. But you cannot start by denying reality and history. And that's what all of these deniers of what were genocidal processes, of what were processes of ethnic cleansing that were absolutely necessary and central to the settler colonial processes, the settler colonial, you know, projects. That's what they're doing. And that's just unacceptable. And that's not a way to get to a better future, which is presumably what we all want.
Let me ask the final question, if you don't mind, and thank you for your time. You know, one of the things in Marcus and I were talking about this is that, in again, drawing those parallels and looking at what's been transpiring and leading up to Palestine, and just the kind of devastation and the understanding that, you know, indigenous peoples are connected to the land. And so, you know, for Palestinians are connected to the land, and just given the right. legacy of scorched earth policies of the land, to the, you know, the burning of, you know, olive trees, to other, you know, plants and animals that Palestinians are connected to and have that relationship, and given the mass displacement and the ongoing genocide, what will it mean to be Palestinian in moving forward?
Well, there's going to have to be a lot of healing. Yeah. But I think there has to be recognition of history. There actually has to be atonement also. You know, we're nowhere near that in North America, obviously. But we're also nowhere near that, unfortunately, in Palestine. You can look at places where there have been attempts at restorative justice, where there have been attempts to deal with the kind of violence that you're talking about, not just violence to people, not just genocide or ethnic cleansing, but or war crimes, but the kind of violence you're talking about to the land, to the environment, to the relationship of people to their lands. You talk about olive trees. I mean, olive trees can live for hundreds of years, and they're kind of symbol of the rootedness of the Palestinian people in their land, and the attacks on them are really an attempt to deny that very rootedness. And it's attacks by these fanatical armed settlers inside the occupied territories. And it's the kind of thing that indicates how difficult this is going to be. We really have to, a lot has to change, not just in Israel. And also in Palestine, a lot of ideas have to change among both peoples, the Palestinians, but especially the Israelis, but also in this country. There are so many false images. We have false images of our own history in the United States, but also of the connection to Israel and of what Israel is like and what this conflict is like. I hope that the book, my book, 100 Years War on Palestine, I hope that it helps to correct some of these false images.
Well, I'd like to thank Rashid Khalidi. I would call you the ambassador of the Palestinian peoples, your family, and the history. Thank you very much for joining us on this vital discussion. Hopefully we can have further discussions, because obviously this subject matter is going to go disappear. But we want to thank you very much for joining us here on the American Indian Airwaves.
It was a privilege. It was an honor. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
The moment of silence is over.
And that was Dr. Rashid Khalidi, who is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies in the History Department at Columbia University, and is the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. He's the author of over 10 publications, including his most recent book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. That concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest for the hour, Dr. Rashid Khalidi. A special thank you to our musical guest, Aragon Star, Kuba Aina, the various artists from Middle Eastern and North African countries, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
And the blood never comes clean from the guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains.
against our fears. Try not to become what we've endured. Wearing our souls on a thread. The moment of silence is over.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
The month of June is Pride Month, an opportunity to shine a light on the vast heritage of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer unquestioning, intersex, asexual or agender, as well as two-spirit community members.